Well, first, a former senior international rugby administrator says world rugby must change when it comes to player welfare. David Moffat was the head of New Zealand rugby in the late 90s, Australia's National Rugby League in the early 2000s. He headed Sport England briefly in 2002 and was head of the Welsh Rugby Union from 2002 to 2005. He's part of a new lobby group, Progressive Rugby, pushing for urgent changes in rugby union rules to protect players from traumatic brain injuries. This while 150 former rugby players have now reportedly joined a landmark legal case in the UK against World Rugby and the England and Wales governing bodies. David Moffat says World Rugby is lagging behind other codes and needs to wake up and recognise that player welfare issues are not going away. He's on the line from Sydney. David, good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Why have you thrown your weight behind this new lobby group, Progressive Rugby?
Well, largely because for some time now I've become very disenchanted with the way in which the game has progressed. And I accept that everything changes, but in rugby, it hasn't changed for the better. And it needs real change. I mean, it's become obsessed with, in the last 10 years, I guess, obsessed with defence. And besides being boring, size of players has become everything. So you now have, 20... coaches picking 23 of the biggest players, and the way in which they play the game is now a collision sport. They coach the players to just smash into the opposition again and again and again, and then when they can't get through the defense, then they kick the ball. So that's the way they decided that the game should be played. But I think an issue that's really caused me some concern in recent times, and it's not, I don't think it's been reported, but it's not going to be long before we see a forward pack weighing 1 ton. Now, you know, and that's a huge amount of weight, which is smashing into the opposition, not only at scrum time, but just generally in general play. And if you have two packs weighing a ton each, you can imagine the sort of, the pressures and the hits. And of course, when you hit, your body stops, but your brain keeps moving inside your skull. And so therefore, it's an accumulation of a lot of these sudden stops that I think is causing a lot of the potential for brain injury. So that's one of the reasons that I wanted to get involved. The game has become a collision sport rather than a contact sport. There are some things that we believe that World Rugby can be doing. We don't want to change the game to the extent that, there's no contact or anything like that, because that's what makes the game. But there has to be changes. And if there aren't any changes, then it'll land at the doorstep in by way of litigation for World Rugby.
I've just been trying to do the sums. Are you suggesting the average weight of a player in a scrum, and obviously they vary, but the average weight's getting up close to 120, 25 Ks. Would that add up to a ton?
Yeah, it would. And it's getting very close to that now. It's normal now for a scrum to weigh over 900 kgs. And with this obsession with size that coaches have, not only in the forwards but also in the backs as well, you can imagine the sort of pressure of a 2 tons of players colliding with each other is going to bring, and that's going to have an effect and a long term effect. I mean, we believe that. Besides the head testing protocols, World Rugby could do some stuff immediately, and I note that they are in certain areas. But I mean, for a start, they should reduce contact in training, which is what the NFL has done. I believe they're close to settling their issues for over $1 billion. It's a matter of saying, okay, what are the pinch points in the game where we can take some action and make the game safer? So reducing contact in training, they could apply their own ruck law. mean, if you have a look, I don't want you to go and do it, Catherine, obviously, but the Law 15 is completely, the ruck law is written completely differently to the way in which it's played. And that's an area where the game is actually suffering, you know, just not only in fact, but in the optics.
Let's stay with it. What's happening? Yes. What's the gap between the rules and what's happening? Start with the ruck.
Okay, so if you take the ruck, it says that players should be on their feet, and that you can't play the ball with your hand, and you can't tackle a player without the ball. So, if for example, you've got a situation where and they're taking some action, but you still see it happen. You can't take a player that's actually standing or positioned on the side of a ruck out, you know, because he hasn't got the ball. You can't tackle a man without the ball. But at the moment, the game just immediately, the ruck, so-called, immediately goes to ground. Well, that's not the way the ruck law is written, Law 15, in the law book. And so if they applied the ruck law, it would take away those shambles that the ruck has become, bind in more players, and you wouldn't have these spread defences. I mean, that's the one thing that they could do that's already a law, and I don't understand why they don't apply it.
What about line-outs? Line-outs is the other thing you've got your eyes on. Obviously, lifting used to be illegal. It's now an absolute feature of the sport. Where is that causing problems in your view?
Well, I mean, you know, even and we must remember that these laws are for everybody. They're not just for the elite players. So elite players can handle lifting in the lineouts, and yet we've seen some players injured because they've got their lifting wrong. You know, they haven't brought the player down properly. But, you know, my concern is at the lower grades as well. They whatever they see on television, they try and replicate, you know, in community rugby. And they don't have the skill, the strength, and the ability to actually get a player from way up high down to the ground without them causing, you know, without the potential for causing serious injury. And I think that's one of the big issues. Everybody focuses on the very top of the game, but you know, we focus on the injuries at the top of the game. But how many injuries have there been lower down, you know, in the community game, that we never hear about, never read about, because they are trying to emulate their stars? I mean, you can understand that they'll do that. Because I mean, I call rugby at the moment McDonald's rugby. It doesn't matter where you go, which village, which town, which city, which country, everybody plays the game the same way, other than the All Blacks, who are trying, you know, to play an expansive game. But all these other countries play exactly the same.
Okay.
Where's the running rugby from Australia? You know, all those things I think have to be thought about.
Okay.
And this, the idea also of can I just sorry,
finish,
Catherine,
finish
I'll
your
just
thought.
Make this
Go ahead. Finish
point.
Your thought.
Yeah. Okay. So we believe that there should only be four replacement players from a bench of eight, because at the moment what happens is, you know, for the last 15 minutes, they truck on a more than half a new team of players that have been sitting on the bench. They are. You know, they're fresh, they're big, they're fast, and all that does is it makes the collisions even worse. And this game ought to be about attrition. You know, you shouldn't be able to do that. So reduce the number of replacement players to four and bring back, you know, the idea that players are going to get tired, and that opens up space for attacking.
We should say, for full disclosure, you've been part of designing a whole reinvention of the game, real rugby you call it, and I'll come back to that. But I'd like to stay first with the diagnosis here. This obsession with size, and obviously there were changes that were brought in with the professional era. Everyone's got their eyes on the professional era for multiple reasons. For a start, players playing and training more is obvious. But the obsession with size and the way the physical confrontations became the focus, as you say, rather than avoiding the physical confrontations and running. When did that really begin to take hold in the sport, and what drove it? What drove the rule changes that fed it, or did it feed the rule changes?
Well, a lot of people will say that this is mostly down to World Rugby, but it's not. It's been the coaches. You know, the coaches have taken control over the way in which they believe the game should be played. And you may remember that when Super Rugby first started in 1996, it was fantastic. You know, we were full grounds and it was attacking rugby. But then, of course, what happens is that the coaches decide, well, this isn't much good for my future career as a coach to, you know, to lose games playing this really great attacking rugby. And this is not just confined to rugby. It's most sports. What you find is that eventually they become obsessed with defense. And so therefore their rules have to change. And that brought in changes to rugby league and the NFL and other sports, because defense became absolutely what it was all about. And coaches are obviously judged on their results. So they've worked out that, you know, they've got to focus on defense. And you hear it all the time, defense wins matches. Yeah, sure it does. But scoring tries also wins matches. And we're seeing a paucity of those at the moment because there just aren't the opportunities for players to, I mean, I'm talking at the top level here, for players to actually make breaks. What's happened to those great Welsh teams that we loved to watch because they were nimble and they were fast and they made the opposition think about it? I mean, you know, they've had the Welshness coached out of them in the last 10 years, and it's not good for the game. I mean, so there's so much to this, but I think the most important issue is the welfare of the players. Now, over here in Australia, there's some debate at the moment about the AFL setting up a $1 billion fund for players for their injuries, including head injuries. But they don't have anything like the amount of head injuries, an opportunity for head injuries that rugby does. So we don't want to get into a fight with World Rugby. We want to work with World Rugby. The only way that this ends up is by, you know, giving lawyers more and more money, which the game can ill afford on both sides of the game. So, you know, we want to work with World Rugby and say, look, this is an issue. It's not going to go away. It's likely to get worse. How can we make this better? The other thing too, and when I talked about optics before, is you have mums and dads watching the game, and they're sort of saying in increasing numbers, well, we don't want our kids to be playing the game the way it's being played at the moment, at the 15-a-side game. And that's, you know, the 15-a-side game is fantastic, but it does need some changes.
I'm interested in, again, who knew what when, David, and when things really began to go askew, because
yep.
I'm looking at this. You were the head of Welsh Rugby. You had a spell in England as well, or Sport England. Both of those unions are being sued along with World Rugby. You headed New Zealand, yes, Rugby in the late 1990s. I mean, do you take some responsibility as a leading administrator for not having done enough then, even if the style of the game has changed in the way we've been discussing? Was enough known well and truly by then, and not enough done?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I would be the first to admit that, you know, we weren't taking it as seriously back in those days as we should have, largely because, you know, there were some head injury protocols that got changed to 6 days off. And, you know, at the time, the view was that was going to be enough. I don't think there was enough understanding of what the cumulative effect of head injuries have been. I mean, but you take Richie, you know, and early on in his career, he suffered a lot of concussions. You know, that seemed to improve later in his career. So I think this started to become an issue, I would say, around about the late 2005, 2010, when the game started to change quite dramatically from what it was to what it has become today. Change is inevitable, but I think when you do institute change, you need to understand what the effects are going to be. And I'm not blaming the administrators or the coaches, it is a fact that they've gone for size and speed, and that is having a detrimental effect. So that needs to be resolved before any litigation. I mean, we don't want litigation. We want to work together to get this. And so one of the things that really, you mentioned real rugby before, one of the things that actually made me say I've had enough of this was when Brodie Retallick was injured by Snyman, the South African forward, prior to the last World Cup. He wasn't doing anything other than minding his own business, and he was taken out of the game. Nothing happened to the player because it was seen as being okay at the time. Brodie Retallick, who I regard as perhaps one of the best rugby players I've ever seen, was out for 6 months prior to the last World, and he wasn't the same player at the World Cup. And too many of those injuries occur at that breakdown. I believe they're now trying to stamp it out, but we still see it. And the referees rightly just send the player straight off. But that's after the event. So the whole thing has got to be a collaborative attempt at changing this between the governing bodies, but importantly the coaches. The coaches have bear a great deal of opp have great opportunity to change this stuff as well. The way in which they instruct and train their players, I think, is terribly important. So you've all got to come together and say, look, this is going to have to change. What can we change it to, which doesn't take away from the ethos of the game, but makes the game safer for the
But
players?
that brings us back to the administrators again and back to World Rugby. And it's interesting. I mean, we talked last week to Jamie Cudmore, who's another mother of the founders of Progressive Rugby, the former Canadian international. And he says, I have got data dating back to the 1970s showing that rugby knew this. Administrators knew the risk of repeated head injuries. And it seems all very well now to be saying it's gone too far. To confirm again, did administrators, was it in the too hard basket for too long by administrators at senior levels?
Well, I suffered a concussion in the 1970s, and there was a mandatory stand down time at that time, I think, of 7 days. Some people might say that that's what affected me, but it wasn't front of mind. I mean, talking as an administrator, it wasn't top of mind to the extent that it is today, I guess. Because I don't think, well, I can never remember receiving, oh, I stand to be corrected, I can never remember receiving anything which outside of the norms of dealing with concussion, which indicated that there was a major problem. And I'm speaking truthfully. I mean, if I had, I would tell you, because that's just the way I am. But yeah, no, I just can't remember it back in the days when I started 1992 at New South Wales Rugby and all the way through. I can't remember. We knew about it, of course. We knew that there was opportunities for head injuries, just like we knew with the scrums that there was opportunities for scrum engagements to end up with players being seriously injured and ending up as paraplegics. So those things were addressed at the time, but never as much sort of focus was placed on concussion and head injuries, you know.
David, you've mentioned these other unions that are moving, and in the US, of course, there's been a massive legal action. But you've mentioned in Australia, the AFL is moving, and other associations as well. Is World Rugby comparatively slow compared to where other organisations are getting?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Catherine, because you'd have to say that given what's been going on around the world, that perhaps they could and should have been a little bit more proactive in this current environment. Because let's face it, there is a duty of care owed by an employer to all of the their employees would happen at RNZ as well, I'm sure. You know, in your own way, there is a duty of care. So I think there's been perhaps a bit of a reluctance to want to take this head on. This group has been formed to actually increase the visibility of this issue, as well as to say to World Rugby, look, we've got a lot of players that actually want to take legal action. We would rather not do that. We would rather work with you. Let's set up a trust and put some, you know, some funds into it and build the funds to help those players who are unfortunate enough to have debilitating injuries in the future. That's what the AFL is doing. And football as well. You know, I played football a lot in the day when the ball was a heavy leather ball, and when it got wet, it was like hitting a rock. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to say that heading the ball in football is also detrimental to, you know, players' head health. And they're dealing with it, but I'm not quite sure they're dealing with it fast enough either. And that's the biggest sport in the world.
This comes at a critical time too for New Zealand rugby. It's at a crossroads in many ways, obviously, with a potential stake being bought by US investors, it is being reported, to try and relieve some financial pressure there. Do you have a comment on that and really the mounting challenges facing the sport at the moment and the extent to which they may dovetail?
They could dovetail because no investor or sponsor wants to be associated with something that gets out of hand, and that's one of the other reasons why we want to take a very structured approach to this, because we don't want anything to affect the viability of the game. But I've looked at the Silver Lake evaluation of New Zealand rugby, and I don't blame Robbo for going out, the chief executive, for going out and trying to find new areas where they can actually make the game healthier financially. But they've got, by buying 15% for nearly $500 million, they're valuing the All Blacks, because that's what they're buying, basically. I mean, it's the All Black brand that drives New Zealand rugby. They're valuing it at $3.1 billion. Now, when you compare that to, let's say, Manchester United, Barcelona, Real Madrid, and a handful of big teams in American sport, that puts the All Black valuation up just behind those teams. Now, that is a massive valuation. Those other teams are valued, I think Manchester United is currently valued about $3.8 billion. This takes it up reasonably close to that. But they're sports that are already, do have their following. Manchester United is worldwide, obviously. And Silver Lake is saying, well, there's 60 million people out there that could be supporters of the All Blacks. That's a big play by them, but they need to know. They presumably know their own business. I mean, they talk about UFC and their involvement there, but it's completely different to the All Blacks. You see, the All Blacks, New Zealand rugby is only in control of its own revenues. It plays in competitions where revenues are shared. It goes and plays against other teams like England, for example, where they don't get any benefit from going and playing there. They don't get any benefit when they come down to New Zealand either. So they don't control the entirety of their revenues, which is what these other sports, like there's another company that's investing in rugby at the moment. They bought Formula One for £1 billion and sold it for $4 billion, but they controlled the entirety of that sport. So what I look at it, I look at the numbers and I say, so Silver Lake's prepared to invest $500 million. Let's say after COVID, New Zealand rugby's revenues are $100 million. So 15% of that is 15 million. So they're investing $500 million, for currently 15 million. That's a big discrepancy. So they obviously believe that they can actually get the All Blacks valuation up to 3.1 billion. But I'm just struggling. Until we see we don't have all the information, obviously, because a lot of it would be confidential. But until we know more about it, it's hard to see. So they need to go into this with their eyes wide open.
The union
And what
does.
the
The
Super
rugby union does, you mean?
Yeah, the rugby
Yeah.
union does, because Silver Lake, they're not a bunch of benefactors. They want a return for themselves and their shareholders. And it's rugby is a niche sport. It's not football. It's not soccer. It's not Real Madrid, Barcelona, and Manchester United, even though the All Blacks is the most valuable brand in the world, in the rugby world, bar none. I mean, it's a phenomenal brand, and somehow, they've got to leverage that.
Much for
But
the
but
unions to
but it,
think
but it's
about before they vote on it, David, in the coming months.
Yeah, they need to. I think they need to ask, and they are asking some very strong questions about it. And what does it actually mean? Obviously, the intent is to put more money back into grassroots rugby, which would be terrific. But I just don't know. For example, are the All Blacks going to have to play 24 matches a year to get anywhere near those revenues? At the moment they play 12, and half of those games are overseas where they don't get any money for them. There's some questions, but I have to applaud the New Zealand Rugby Union for looking at alternative
All right.
ways of which they can raise money.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time. David Moffat, who has joined this new lobby group, Progressive Rugby, he's a former head of New Zealand Rugby from the late 90s, also the Australia's National Rugby League in the early 2000s. He headed Sport England briefly 2002 and was head of the Welsh Rugby Union from 2002 to 2005. As I mentioned, he's also part of a group promoting an adaptation of rugby, real rugby it's called, as a means of dealing with some of the rule and other developments he sees has taken the sport backwards.